Good afternoon. My name is David Watson. My colleagues on my right are firstly Ben Uy and secondly Andrew Gale. We're going to share the podium here. They'll be doing most of the talking. I'll be doing most of the managing, but we won't go there. Andrew's going to start, lead off the batting. Andrew is the Chief Actuary for Medibank Private, position he's held for a little over 10 years. Prior to that, he was with... what generation was it then? Call it Bupa, or what is now Bupa, and has a very lengthy experience in health insurance and has been a major supporter of the biennial conventions in particular. Ben is one of the younger brigade who has stepped up to the mantle. Ben is with KPMG Actuarial. He's the appointed actuary of three health insurers. Writes the newsletter and has done for nearly 7 years and has kept that going very well. These sessions have been going since Darwin in 99. That makes this the seventh session of contemporary issues. There's a thread that goes through them. Those who have been around all of that time will recognise the thread. It's about contemporary issues in private health insurance. There is no similar session elsewhere in the biennial program. Seven down, and we'll keep going. I think with that we might lead off, and I'll call Andrew to the podium.
Yeah. Well, David's right. We first did this sort of thing in 99, and I think some of you were here at 99, and I think every practice area had a thing called contemporary issues in superannuation, life insurance, etc. We're the only ones that have kept it going, and I think the idea here is it's going to be an interactive session. We've got a whole stack of slides, but we don't have to use them. Interject, put your hand up, and we'll try and take it then. If we spend too long there, we'll sort of move on, and I'm sure we'll run out of time. But the idea is for those who are involved in health insurance and those that are not involved in health insurance to learn perhaps something new, just in an interactive way. Now, David says he's going to do the managing and I'm going to do the talking. Perhaps it should have been the other way around, but we'll see how we go. So we've got a few agenda items. We really want to have a look at how things have been going in the last little while in the health insurance industry, membership trends, price increases, the state of the industry, merger and acquisitions, cost pressures, and some of the other things you see on the slide. Many of you have seen this graph before, and I think we've probably stolen it from FIAC's website. It's the percentage of the Australian population that's got hospital insurance over a very long period of time, since the early 70s, and some of you may be surprised to know that as much as 80% of the population voluntarily purchased private health insurance back in the early 70s. But you can see the long downhill slide before the relatively recent, I suppose, government incentives that are in place through, the three pillars, really, the 30% rebate and its 35 and 40% counterparts, the Medicare levy surcharge, extra tax for those that don't have private health insurance, that's the stick, and then lifetime health cover, I suppose, another stick, but it was sort of a carrot just before it came in. People got in before the deadline. And we've had a pretty benign 10 years, really. If you look at that graph, it's we've had a very flat, uneventful time, let's say. I suppose it's still been eventful, but nothing like the late 1990s. And I suppose that's really embodied by this sort of a chart. We've had... I suppose that is the last 10 years, a period where we've had some periods of very strong growth, in fact, up towards 4% growth per annum. And it's eased back a bit in the last couple of years to something more like 1.5% to 2%, but it's still growth like we hadn't seen prior to the last 6 or 7 years. Just prior to the start of this graph, of course, we've got that massive boom we had through lifetime health cover, but it was sort of a one-off event in a the graph you saw previously was on a slow decline. So I think, we look back on this last 10 years and can be very pleased with the way that things have turned out for the industry. It could well have been a lot worse, of course. And those that perhaps lived through the 90s might have something to say in the discussion as well.
Andrew, what do you mean by the GFC impact?
Sorry, I didn't say GFC, did I? LHC, I meant, from 10 years ago. Is that what I mean?
Yeah, I'm just looking at the slide.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying the last 2 years have been slowed down the growth a bit. So I don't put that necessarily down to GFC. I might put that down to perhaps the indexing of the MLS threshold. That's meant that younger people perhaps don't have the same incentive to come in now than they did, or those starting to earn a reasonable income. I mean, the 50,000 wasn't changed for 11 years, so that started to bite at just above average incomes, really. Above even starting salaries.
So is GFC impact a mistake?
Where's that? Oh, that's sorry. That's Ben's put these slides together. I'm going to have to.
I think that.
No, it's just more of a question. I'm not letting you get away with it.
Well, I mean, maybe that's an open question. Does anybody think that the industry's been affected by the GFC in any particular way? I mean, it could have been in terms of affordability, but we haven't seen a dropout in people covered. We've just seen a slowing in the rate of growth. And you look at this chart, take off the last 4 or 5 years, we hadn't been growing at this sort of rate. So, maybe the GFC's got some small impact. I suppose it is a bit of a question mark, but I'd put most of it down to the MLS impact. I should read the slide, shouldn't I? Now, Ben's put together a whole lot of detail here. I'm not going to go step through this. I suppose just the headline of this is that there's two groups. There's some funds that have grown rapidly in the last couple of years, and they're listed from fastest growing down to slowest growing, effectively. And the group at the bottom are perhaps growing at a slower rate. Sort of a bit of extension from what I was talking about earlier, that there's a range of experiences throughout the industry in terms of growth. And many of these funds are smaller, and there'll be special circumstances around them growing, and there has been some consolidation activity for some of these, but that's not the primary reason for growth. So there are still a number of funds growing off very small bases. I mean the one at the top, which is One Medi Fund, it's we're talking about growth from 2,000 to 3,000 to 4,000. It's large percentages, but on a very small base, and they are a newly established fund, so there's probably circumstances about them. Of the larger funds, you can see NIB has had the most rapid growth rate over that period. I don't think you can go anywhere without seeing an NIB ad these days. I seem to see them at every turn. Very, very effective at getting their message out in the market. So market share, I should be familiar with who are the largest players, and I suppose the significant point about this, and it's been made in some of the earlier health insurance presentations, is that by market share, the industry is predominantly for-profit now, and that's, even though that's 70 or 71% has been that way for a year or so, go back a year or two before that and it wasn't like that. But by number of funds, obviously there's still a lot of not-for-profits. A different way of looking at the membership growth we've had in the last 10 years or so is just by age band, just to see where the growth has come. And the one that I'd focus on is that 25 to 39 age band, a very important one for the demographic mix and getting the younger members in to cross-subsidise the older and sicker. We've seen that turn around over the 10 years from rates of decline of 2 or 3% per annum to rates of growth of 2% and even higher for a few years. Once again, I think you could probably see this being impacted by that MLS rebasing. And it's slowed down again, but it's still growing, which I think is a very positive thing for the industry. At the older age group, 60-plus, it's not that I think we're recruiting lots of people. It's just, the baby boomers, the ageing of the population from one age bracket to another, we're just going to get that constant level of growth for a little while, I think. 4%, it looks quite alarming when you look at it like that, and the costs that come with it.
Only new hips.
Yes.
So they're
torn up. Yeah. But I still think, while that... Have I got one of these things? Yeah. While this area is growing, I think, that's still favourable. If we end up back here again, then we're going to see deterioration in the demographic mix and a jump in the cost of ageing. So this is yet another way of looking at the same thing, but it's looking at the percentage of the population by age band that's got hospital insurance. So you remember that overall number of about 45%, I think, that black line. You know, it's been, as I said, it's been pretty constant for about 10 years. But what's been happening with age groups? Well, you can see this red one, that's 65 to 84, has gone from 40% to 50% of the population in 10 years. And then the younger age groups here, 25 to 34, started at 35, dropped a couple of percent, back just above 35, but has been pretty flat since the rebasing of those MLS income tests. And some declines here at 45 to 54. So there's a flat line, but it sort of belies the underneath there's some things going on in some of the key age groups.
The 65 to 84 is also influenced by cold card.
Yes, that's a very important point. This 65 to 84, there's a segment of the population that have gold cards under Department of Veteran Affairs. It's the result of, you know, past conflicts. You know, I like to say we haven't had a war for a while, which is a good thing, but what it means is that that gap in the health insurance population is going to be filled in time, and, you know, it's going to be costly. So the money that the government tips into DVA, Department of Veteran Affairs, at the moment for gold cards, you know, it's not going to come our way as an industry. I wouldn't have thought it's going to be funded out of future premiums.
We can only think what 25 to 34 would have been if 150,000 had come in.
Correct, and I think that's why that. Yeah, so that's why that was a very important issue for the industry. You know, a key argument around the point, what's the right number? Obviously, 50,000 not being indexed for 11 years wasn't the right answer, but it had led to a particular outcome, and we needed to find a way forward to manage it without too much fallout, and I think that's probably happened by looking at these figures. And I suppose that just puts it all into one aggregate number that says what's the cost of ageing if we didn't have any health costs inflation, price inflation in terms of paying more to providers, but just we had the shifting age profile that you've seen on the previous charts, how much does that drive costs up? And it's running around about 1.5% per annum. There was a period when it was perhaps lower than 1, and then historically it's been more like 2. So
what's that graph?
So this graph says take last year's population times last year's cost per age, get an average price. Take this year's population by last year's cost per age, you get a new price. Just the impact of just changing the age mix. Of course, you're paying more to your providers in terms of prices, and you know you've got higher utilisation. I suppose part of the utilisation is in the age mix, really.
And Andrew, do you have an idea how that varies by individual insurer?
You can do those calculations, Rob, through the data that's made available to insurers, and it will vary quite a lot. Now, of course, you know, you can do these things before and after risk equalisation. After risk equalisation will mute them quite a bit, but, of course, if insurers have got a slow growth path and an ageing profile, they'll have a bigger number than this. Average age, I don't particularly think average age is terribly useful, but it's a proxy to what's going on that ageing, in a sense. The average age is just creeping up a little bit by a little bit. With I suppose, Australia's population.
Crack
40. 40, yeah.
Life begins.
And many people in the room will know this. The average price increase, Nicola Roxon publishes the average rate increase every year that is probably... How many days? 11 or 12 days old, the current version of 5.6%. I mean, if you look at this in an historical context, you know, it's been reasonably constant over the last little while. We've had those periods where it sort of spiked up, and then we had the lifetime health cover period where there was virtually no rate increases across the industry.
It was deferred.
It was,
Basically deferred those price increases. 4 years, which is a follow-up from your work you did.
No, I suppose that's the price of the selection effect that happened from lifetime health cover. Yeah.
Well, it's obvious now, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you've got broad aging of 1.5% observation, those prices don't look too bad.
Correct. No, I think that's... you know, it's easy to try and benchmark these to CPI and things like that. It's sort of the wrong benchmark, isn't it? Because we're, the rate increase from the industry is not actually a price measure. It's a price plus volume measure, or price plus utilisation measure.
Plus the demographic drift.
Yeah.
And you should compare it to Medicare, for example. Medicare costs.
Yeah.
You're running at about 9%.
So there are some figures on health costs per person in the... Australian health system that compare reasonably favourably with these sorts of numbers.
So there, John, they're not tabular rate increases, Andrew. These are FCIs.
This is the particular formula that's used by the department. It's the change in forecast contribution income in the scenario where you have the rate increase versus not. So they are affected by the fact that some people have rate protection and it takes a while for people to move on to new rates. Yeah. So, this is probably a bit busy, this chart, but it's just... showing the spread of rate increases that have happened over the last 2 years. The blue is April 2010 and the red is April 2011. It's got a log scale to sort of fit everything, all the smaller funds onto the chart a bit more visibly. But, you know, there's a spread, as you probably expect, a spread of rate increases close to the averages of around about 5.6 or something. But there are always a couple of funds that are a fair distance away for the unique circumstances.
Andrew, what would be interesting to find is that since the Labor government's come in, there's been a different way of measuring how rate increases have been accepted. Whether the bands are much wider or much narrower now than they were before.
Yeah.
But is that due to the Labor government, or is that due to... Or is that due to more stability in the industry in that downstream period well after lifetime health cover? We could argue about it.
Yeah.
Please continue.
Okay. just for a bit of fun, we sort of decided we'd try to do a regression of rate increase on margin performance, and you know it's probably not perfect because it's looking at last year's margin. Probably should be looking at the current year's margin, which is unknown. But there does seem to be some sort of reasonably strong correlation between the rate increase that funds have just had and the margins that they achieved last year.
Who's the extreme right blue point?
I'm not sure that I can tell you who each of these are, and obviously... Obviously, they're not all the same size funds, and yeah. In fact, I think it's probably good that we protect the anonymity of all of these people. If you're interested, I'm sure you can go and research this a bit more. The other one that we tried is we tried to plot a correlation between the April 2011 rate increase and the June 30, 2010 solvency multiple. It's in the FIRC annual report. And I know solvency is not CAPAD, and there will be different circumstances, but it doesn't look like there's as much of a correlation there. There's a much larger range of outcomes. I mean, it's all there publicly to know, but it may surprise you. There's a lot of funds that are sort of 7, 8, 9, even 14 times the solvency multiple. All small, yeah, you're right. But some smaller ones here, like, for instance, you know, very low rate increase, but let's say the lowest solvency multiple in the industry. So, and then here's another one way up here having a large rate increase. So there's all extremes in this one. I think there's less correlation here than the previous chart. Just some big headline numbers about, you know, how many players, 37 players and $14 billion of revenue. Last year's margin was 4.5. We've sort of been there before, but it's heading towards the high end of recent experience. I think I've got a chart following that shows the time series. Yes, but investment income's not there, is it? So the difference between profit and net margin is investment income. Obviously, in FY09, that was negative, and it's rebounded again in FY10. There are a handful of funds that have got exposure to growth assets, equities, and the like, and were certainly affected in FY09.
How did you get the capital adequacy capital result?
Because that comes out of a figure that's published by FEAC as well, just as a headline industry number rather than individual insurers. So they've actually published this on a quarterly basis now, as well as the overall P&L for the industry on a quarterly basis. And that's where this comes from, is the 12 months to December 2010, the most recent reported period. The net margin has moved up again a little bit too, to 4.9, 1% up on the prior year. And there's the chart I was anticipating that shows, I think in the, which one is it? The black line is the net margin as a percentage of contribution income. So, you know, sort of around this 4 to 5% mark, which has been the highest in this post-LHC period. You can see the massive impact of lifetime health cover, a big profit as a lot of people entered the industry subject to waiting periods, and then a net margin loss as that second year of claims experience came through. And then, of course, through the 90s, very variable but generally negative underwriting profits or net margin. That cycle seems to have been broken now. I think it's, as I was saying before, it's highly linked to the stability of membership that we've experienced.
So, Andrew, can I make a
comment? Yeah, sure.
The 2002 drop in profit is more than just a slick period.
Yeah.
It was a period where a number of funds changed their products and there was a lot of individual migration within funds. So a lot of it was kind of... It was depleting their own margins. You know, there was an element of selection, but I think in the main it was about product design.
Yeah, I think.
Cannibalisation.
Yeah, so many people would know some of the situations with some insurers, and to be fair, it's easy to judge now, isn't it? But at the time, nobody really had much idea how many people would join. Those that remember can think back to, you know, long queues for people wanting to join up and buy health insurance, flyers in newspapers, write your name here, we'll sort it out later. It was just amazing. It had to be extended by 2 weeks. It was a period that will probably, I don't know what it rivals. It probably rivals the very early days of, I know my own organisation, Medibank, when it started, had something similar. The old heads talk about something like that. It's one of those once-in-a-generation type events.
And none of the actuaries got it anywhere near their right guess, did they?
No, I don't think so, and I think it was a very difficult period to manage through.
About 10% increase in membership.
Right. 50. It shows you the power of a stick, really, doesn't it? And, everybody... It was announced the year before, but no one did very much, and it all came in a rush... just before the deadline, and the industry really couldn't handle the volumes. So easy to look back on that period, but very difficult to predict what was going to happen, I think.
What's your view on the net margins going forward in view that contribution income is going up 6-7 with rate protection, so you're looking at a lot higher than that, and the cost base in terms of, say, salaries,
well, I think it it's less about what's happening to management expenses, which are probably 8 to 10% of the cost base, and more to do what's happening to the provider charges and utilisation and the ageing. So, I mean, this has been fairly stable through this period, hasn't it, really? So I suppose that means in aggregate over those period of years, and you can argue that what is the right level or what is the desirable level, but you can say over a period of 4 or 5 years, the pricing's been about right to fund the costs. So, you know, yes, these look... We've pulled back from the historic highs of 5% a little, but maybe we're heading back there again. But that in aggregate, they're sort of keeping us at a level. Peter?
I see what happens in private health insurance a bit like what's happening in some other industries. You're not comparing like with like year by year. Sorry, I'm just going to make this quick comment. I mean, people spend more on travel now, although the costs of airline flights have gone down dramatically. They spend a lot more on electronics, although the cost of computers and software have fallen very dramatically. The same thing's happening in private health. You're actually buying different things year after year after year. And so it's not true inflation in that sense. It's not comparing like with like. People are deciding to spend more of their income on what they're getting. Old people can have hip replacements never thought of before.
Yeah. Now, that's true, and I think, you know, just come back to the comment I tried to make before, it's price plus volume are encapsulated into our one product. And unfortunately, everyone's an individual and they may not see it quite like that they're getting more and more because you either get something or you don't. But in aggregate, that's true across our insured population. We are doing more of these things on an age-adjusted basis.
Andrew, when did actuaries get a regulated role in private health insurance projections?
Yeah, I think that was...
2003?
It might have actually been even 2002. 2003 rate change, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, the April 2003 rate change. I think that's...
After the lifetime health cover shock.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's interesting that actuarial involvement... You know, I'm trying to give us a pattern about it.
It's at that low point.
But I think it was somewhere there, 2003, 2004, somewhere around that time. Things have, under actuarial control, things have stabilised a bit.
Right.
We've seen the premium increases haven't necessarily been stable, but you know, the outcomes for insurers and for the industry as a whole have been more stable.
Well, I think there's a whole lot of influences. Of course, that would be one of them. The other one is a more, let's say, benign membership change environment, and of course the actuaries aren't the final arbiter on price. That's the board and management. Well, it's, I mean, that's a matter of speculation, I suppose. Most of the for-profit insurers, well, at least the ones that are demutualised, have said that they don't, you know, it's not really going to have any effect on their pricing and their margin performance. So that remains to be seen how margins pan out. And you could argue, maybe, you know, is there more competition? Are they going to actually drive the margins down a little bit as they compete more heavily with each other? I don't know. I'm conscious that I've got three slides, and then you can ask Ben questions. But management expenses, just to give you a sense of what's happening across the... This is the 37 funds, again, by where their managed expense is, and there's, as I said, they sort of sit just below 9 to 10% management expense ratio, but there are some that are 5 or 6%, and some that are in the teens, even as high as 16%. So, and it doesn't really matter whether you doesn't seem to matter whether you're a big fund or a small fund. Your funds at both ends of the spectrum seem to find ways to be above or below the industry average. So, whether that means there's no economies of scale, I don't know, or people just spend up to an average. And some of these funds at the smaller end, I think. There's some element in which their cost base is lower because they're a restricted membership organisation, or their costs are either overtly or indirectly subsidised by the sponsor of that insurer. And there's always the vexed issue about, you know, what's a management expense and what's a expenditure to sort of drive benefit costs lower. So There's always a bit of a grey area about, you know, health management programs and that sort of thing. And risk equalisation, the topic that I know health insurance actuaries love to talk about and have theoretical discussions about. But the scheme that we've got has been in place for a number of years. We had a bit of a change in 2007 where we tilted the pooling factors, but fundamentally it's a pooling of costs for older people that happens after the event, and the costs per SEU are increasing and sort of now hit about just over $500 and growing at 7 or 8% per annum. This is effectively the levy that all members pay to subsidise the or finance the costs of the elderly. We've got about 40% of total benefits coming into this pooling arrangement, and it's been creeping up, and we won't say much more about that because I know Jamie's paper tomorrow morning is on this very topic. So I might leave it there and hand over to Ben.
Thank you, Andrew. Probably just add my 2 cents worth to the question of the net margin trends as well. Probably worth keeping an eye on when, I guess, actuaries implement capital management plans and how that will affect net margins going forward for the next couple of years. So I guess Andrew sort of covered all the numbers slides of all mine, but just wordy ones now. So I just want to touch on some of the other issues that are affecting health insurance. So just over 4 years ago, I guess, the Health Insurance Act came in. And since then, there have been a number of amendments to the supporting rules. The Act itself hasn't actually changed. And as we know that there are rumours of reviews on risk equalisation, we've heard that there's something in the background, risk-based capitation. Perhaps Flack can jump in there. Also in the background, there's been numerous drafts on the capital standards, particularly solvency and capital adequacy. Again, we've sort of yet to see anything concrete or the next draft coming up for that. How do you go forward? Not working. Over the last couple of years as well, there have been quite a fair bit of M&A action, and the most recent one everyone probably is aware of in this room is the attempted offer from NIB to buy out GMHBA. So that was late last year. And prior to that, we had, I guess, fairly old news now, Medibank taking out AHM and HCF acquiring MU. And the rest you've probably seen from the last Contemporary Issues workshop. I'll put some else. Oops, wrong one. Other issues that are affecting health and health insurance cost pressures, I suppose, insurance and health cost pressures. I probably won't go through all of it, but generally for health insurance, there's benefit inflation and utilization are the most obvious ones. We thought on the left we have the cost pressures, and on the right, yeah, just have the health cost pressures. It's a bit of a contrast. Against the health insurance cost pressures. So bit of a benchmark, health spending has gone up. Over time, there's been technological advances, prostheses, pharmaceuticals, et cetera, and aging population.
For those in the audience who aren't familiar, could you please explain table drift?
Table drift is a term coined by Andrew, probably.
David.
I think Andrew called it... Brent,
call it,
revenue degradation or table drift. What it is basically when a member downgrades without a corresponding downgrade in, say, claims. So they might go for cheaper product but still being on claim, for example. So as a result, the insurer just loses revenue without losing any of their claims experience. So that's table drift. So I'm conscious of time, so I'll rush through some of these so that we can have a bit more discussion. Political influences, as you know, health insurance, the largest risk is sovereign risk, and we've got quite a number of political influences, and David looks like he's going to jump in.
My understanding of the rebate tier situation is that certainly the legislation failed 2 years ago.
Legislation was not passed in the Senate 2 years ago. It is government policy to have the rebate tiers arrangements in place. This is disclosed in the budget papers last year and in the briefing papers for the incoming government, and there's been no change to that. The minister has referred to it in a number of press releases across in the intervening months. But my expectation is that the government would have the legislation ready to go. I would expect it to look pretty much the same as it did 2 years ago. The dollar amounts and the effective dates might be a bit changed, but my understanding is it is still feasible to introduce it from the 1st of July 2011. The effect would not be felt until tax returns were done roughly 12 months later. May not happen, but of course this is a political issue as well, given the sensitive state of the House of Representatives. So I think it's a matter of watch this space, see what happens.
Thanks for that, David. Other influences are, of course, the national health reforms, Medicare Select, Medicare, Medicare Local, federalisation of hospitals, if you like. So all that's watch this space for now. Just a bit of a slide on the key stakeholders in the health insurance arena. Obviously, you have the agencies, the governments, regulators, FIAC, DOHA, FIO, etc. The providers, hospitals, doctors, the insurers, and then you have, I guess, the third parties like actuaries, rating agencies, iSelects, and of course, lastly, the members, the policyholders, contributors. The next slide on FIAC activities is a bit of a summary, and I think Hayden will jump in after I speak to provide a FIAC's perspective, but this is sort of our take on it. So FIAC has a new commissioner, Lynn Ralph, and they've got two other new commissioners as well. As far as I know, that there are two other commissioners of which their terms were due to expire in March, but has been extended to June. So there's a potential change, I guess, in culture of the board of FIAC. A number of SOPs. Sorry?
December.
Thank you. There you go. Newsflash, December. Sorry?
I thought it was June.
Right.
Website says June.
Yeah,
there's two steps in the extension. In other words, the appointment process is as disastrous as it ever was with respect to
In any case, there'll be a change in the commissioners, the board. There's continued attention on risk management and governance. We mentioned before capital standards review. Hayden's a new addition to the FIAC team. He's a qualified FIAA, although there's been other members like Carl and Tracy, I think. I'm not sure who the two other members are, but that's a total of five all up, which is a plus for the actual profession. And so October last year, FIAC and the health insurance appointing actuaries got into a room and discussed the AA role. Those discussions on feedback on the FCR and how the AA role could be improved. FIAC has also given sort of face-to-face individual feedback to a number of AAs regarding the FCRs. And FIAC is quite supportive of the PA 600 that's currently in draft and about to go out as a second exposure to members. There's a new FIAC governance standard that came out from 1 January 2010. Key changes include board composition requirements. Every board must have a board charter, raising issues on performance, and boards must ensure FIAC have access to senior management, etc. We're running out of time, aren't we? Other developments happening in the background, IFRS, there's a bit of a contentious issue at the moment on the boundary of the contract. So currently health insurance has been sort of grouped together with long-tail business, which I personally disagree with. But submissions have been made in November last year, and again, that's just watch this space.
The latest draft. IASB is it'll be short term.
Okay, that's good. Thank you. The Health Practice Committee, what have we been doing the last 2 years since the last session? Again, just touching on the PS600. We also we did plan to review the guidance note. I think not a whole lot have been done in that space, mainly because we've been focusing on getting the PS600 out first. The PHI course has been updated. Newsletters have been going. There's now currently 223 editions. HPC meets every 2 months, roughly, and we also have appointed actuary lunches where appointed actuaries get together and share ideas, and the last one was held in January, courtesy of Medibank at the tennis. there is an increased focus in water health by the HPC. Sophie is the new convener from, I think, June 2010 last year, and there's been quite a bit of work done by Rob and Kirsten, as well as Sophie, on setting policies and guidelines and submissions on the wider health reforms in the background. And David, you want to jump in?
And I wanted to acknowledge the work that Tig Melville did as the predecessor of all of us in this room in health insurance, and did a major consulting report in health insurance for HCF in 1958. And my managing director has allowed me to bring along a copy of the report and has said that if you pay the right amount of money and you wear plastic gloves or rubber gloves, you'll be able to look at it. But it is, for those who haven't seen it, and some have, if you haven't seen it, it's well worth having a quick browse for a moment or two, and I'll be standing around after the session for that purpose. Tig's biography is at the, I think it's autobiography, is available at the Institute's website, and it's well worth reading the adventures of a leading actuary, foremost in the consulting world in Australia and in health insurance some time back. With that, I might continue the tradition of the last few sessions and invite a representative of FEAC to come forward and say a few words.
Thank you. Hayden Burno from FEAC. I'll just have about maybe 5-10 minutes of quickly going through some graphs and thoughts.
They're not on it.
They're not on it at all?
No,
I'm getting the time. Okay. all right, I might go back to your net margin. We've probably said we've already covered a lot of what I was going to talk about here. Reasons for the recent good performance. One thing I wanted to take out of this graph was an important implication, which is when you have net margins and profit at this level, what's that done to the industry's level of capital? So I did have a capital graph, which I'll try and illustrate for you in your minds. Basically, around and this story is true whether you're talking about solvency or CAPAD multiple. CAPAD multiple is a bit different. It's been a bit more geared by the change in net margin recently, but these comments apply to both. So, around 2002, 2003, 2004, when we had these low net margins and reasonably low profits, those profits weren't sufficient to increase the industry's capital in real terms, and industry's capital was going downwards during that period. Over this period, 2005, 2006, 2007, if you look at the graph, 2005, 2006, profits of those levels were sufficient to increase the industry's capital quite significantly. From 2006 onwards, the graphs show quite a drop-off in industry capital since that point, and also a bit of bumpiness. And some of the bumpiness is due to movements in inadmissible assets. They've largely cancelled each other out over that period. So the downward trend is mainly due to dividend payments, so which have been quite sizable over that period from the for-profit insurers. So from 2006, the solvency multiple was 3. Sorry, 3.5. And had those dividend payments not been made, it would have continued to increase, as it did over the previous years, to about 4.3. So 3.5 to 4.3 without the dividend payments. But it's actually gone 3.5 down to 3 with the dividend payments. So the main point I wanted to take from that is that the current net margins are at a level which is sufficient to continue to increase the industry's capital. So if that's a way that you measure the health of the industry, then you'd say it's healthy. I guess also if you measured the health of the industry by comparison to historical standards, you'd also say it's in a pretty healthy sort of position. My graph then had some question marks at the end, which, the big question, I guess, particularly for us actuaries and the space where we probably add most value is thinking about what's going to happen next. And I just thought it'd be interesting to take a show of hands as to, let's say, average net margins over the next 4 years. How many people think there'll be three options? One option is that net margins will stay within plus or minus 1% of where they are now. One is that they'll be more than 1% higher or less than 1% lower. So who thinks they'll be they'll average more than 1% higher over the next 4 years? Who thinks they'll be within a band of plus or minus 1% from where they are now? Right, quite a lot of hands. And who thinks that they're most likely to be more than 1% lower than where they are now? So that's it. Very interesting. Probably a tie between within 1% or more than 1% lower. So, I mean, one interesting way of thinking of it is probably...
Excuse me, what's your bid?
I decline.
And
thanks.
Before you say, can I get your fair colleagues to stand next year and we'll have their bids as well?
I won't make a bid. It's interesting to think about the good scenario, that there's probably some pressures. If a good scenario did eventuate, there's probably competition might have an effect of dampening that extra performance, and you'd have to think that regulation of premium increases might also dampen those effects. Those two strong influences probably wouldn't operate in the opposite direction if some bad scenarios eventuated.
Hayden, what about the $1.2 billion of investment income write-offs? You know, there was 2 years there and there was no investment income in the industry.
Yep.
And that had an effect, you see. And I think margins got pushed up because of that, and then they'll come back down to compensate for the industry getting a reasonable return on its investments again.
Okay, yeah. So... given that we've a large number of people have said there's pretty good probability that margins are going to go down, and we've also seen a lot of potential policy changes that could have potentially negative impacts. There's other things that could happen. There could be a big new competitor, perhaps, enter the market. Economic downturn, all sorts of things could lead to some bad scenarios, and I guess as the conservative prudential regulator, they're the kind of things that occupy my thoughts.
Would you like to give us your views on various sorts of sovereign risk?
No, I wouldn't like to do that. Thank you. But
when's capital standards coming out?
Okay, I'll come to that. I guess why I mention these downside risks is just with the intention of promoting thinking about them a bit more in the actuarial community, that these big potential sort of game-changing events. I guess there's probably at some stage there'll be a big event, and the extent to which actuaries have prepared insurers for those events and put things in place which will minimise perhaps severity of outcomes, I think will determine the amount of credibility that actuaries have in the industry post the change. But there might also be possibilities for actuaries to help individual insurers position themselves better than other insurers post-change. So I think those are probably two fairly strong incentives for actuaries to have a good look into these possibilities.
This big event, or big events, are they going to occur on 4 weeks today?
The federal budget is handed down on the 10th of May, which is Tuesday, 4 weeks from today.
No, I'm not commenting on that. I'm just saying that over the next few years there could be things that happen. I wanted to take another show of hands. Now that I'm talking about adverse scenarios, and actuaries are all about thinking about how bad things could get, the next show of hands is, what about the scenario of net margins getting down to a level where capital in the industry is noticeably dropping off, so that net margins might have to come down, let's say, 3% or more for that to happen? How likely do we think that is? So sometime in the next 4 years, there'll be an event which would cause a 3% shock to net margins. So who thinks there's greater than a 0.01% chance of that happening?
Greater than 0.01% chance of that happening?
Okay. Keep your hands up, everyone, please. Keep them up if you think it's greater than 1%, this bad shock.
Yeah. So are you talking about a bad shock being a bad decision by the minister? Or are you leaving that out of it?
Any bad shock that you can possibly think of.
Because it changes.
Sure, anything at all. So greater than 1%, now keep them up if it's greater than 10%. Greater than 25%?
How can you not think a minister will make a very bad decision? In one of the next 4 years.
Yep. It could be worse than they've
made in
the last.
You can get your answer from the graph there. Just look at the graph. It tells you every 10 years or so we have a pretty rough time.
See, I think that this could stimulate an hour's worth of very, very valuable discussion. So that kind of question, I think, would be very useful for you to even discuss amongst yourselves. That's about all I had.
Well, thank you very much, Hayden. That's not quite what I expected you to say. But I will say it was a very vibrant discussion, and I can't remember a show of hands in a contemporary issues session before, but I think it did contribute to a good session. We still have a little bit more time. Are there any more general questions or comments anybody wants to make? Could you?
I'd just like to know if anyone, with the budget coming up and the means testing of the rebate, has anyone done any modelling of the impact of cover downgrading and that affecting prices and then that flowing through to more cover downgrading? Has anyone done any of that? Because I'm asking that question because when it came up on the slide here, it was a fairly relaxed statement that it might happen and there was no energy from the audience to jump in and worry about it. And I'm just wondering whether collectively we've concluded that it's a non-issue or whether we... I'm not sure what our current thinking is. I know individual funds have thought this through in the last year or so. Is that enough? Is that where we've got to?
I know that it's an issue with some of the insurers who are resisting what they see as the pressures in the marketplace to degrade benefits rather than to raise prices. And they believe the political controls that have been imposed on price levels. And I connect this to my earlier comments about the nature of the product itself is changing, that the one response to that changing environment in which they're operating is to raise prices and to keep benefits basically quite good, and another response is to degrade your benefits and to keep your prices at a relatively low level. And it seems that there is with the pressure to make more profits, especially with the demutualisations that have gone on in the industry, there seems to be a macro change in the industry, if you like, right across the industry, in terms of degrading benefits. And some funds are finding that challenging, and they feel that that's a problem now. Anyway, that's something that hasn't been addressed in this meeting, and I think it is an issue for some of our clients.
I mean, yeah, sorry, I'll just quickly... I can't offer any specific numbers, but I think it is a bit like, you know, the iceberg. The top of the iceberg is going to be the number of people that exit cover completely, and there have been numbers done by Treasury, and, you know, the impact may well be quite small there. There'll be those that downgrade their cover in the face of a 42% price increase. I think that's the number if your rebates were drawn. And there'll be those that exit ancillary cover. Downgrading...
I'm not talking about individuals. No. I'm talking about products themselves being downgraded by adding exclusions and changing co-payments and adding a whole lot of features like that. Reduce the effect, isn't it, of the...
Well, that's right, but those are actions by the insurer. When it comes to the means testing, if you are losing your rebate, you know, you'll be facing a large increase in price to stay where you are, and you may well decide to drop your ancillary cover, keep your hospital because you've got the lifetime health cover penalties, you've got the surcharge, or downgrade by taking a bigger excess or taking exclusions. And we talked about table drift before and how that is probably going to be a net margin loss to the insurer if those sort of things happen. But a lot of this is, you know, we haven't got anything really in our past history to test against, and, you know, it's actions of individuals, admittedly a small percentage of our insured population.
One of the things that we've looked at is if it comes in, how will it be administered? Yeah, will it be administered through the tax system, or will the fund send a letter out? And I think the two will result in two different scenarios.
I sit on a task force which is currently not convened, but may be convened when the legislation gets back into Parliament. And in the cycle 2 years ago, a very clear expectation was that this is a matter largely for tax returns. Insurers can set up systems so that people can anticipate the right level of rebate that they're going to get. But there'll be, as I understand it, no compulsion on people to tell the truth. And a lot of people can't tell the truth about their income at the beginning of the year. I think most of us probably can't tell the truth about how tax returns are going to end up just at the end of the year. And that might mean that significant numbers of people have a tax debt when they do their tax returns because they've received the benefit of the rebate across the course of the year. But when their tax returns are done, it turns out that they have no eligibility for the rebate. But yes, there are some administrative problems around this.
2 years ago, I thought that way as well. It does dawn on me now, though, that I'm assuming that despite the underlying economics having changed, I was assuming that people are stupid enough not to notice that because of the way the admin works. And in the short term, I agree with Tory that whether it's high profile or low profile makes a big difference. In the medium term, I'm thinking I may have underestimated the intelligence of consumers.
Peter.
Undoubtedly, there's a lot of people in the detail here. Complacency due to the fact that...
Peter Lurie. Complacency due to the fact that when the threshold changes, it didn't have much impact on membership. And the fact that these measures didn't get up last time. But the point I want to make is outside of the impact on private health insurers, it's the other providers in that provider section that Ben put up there whose businesses could be damaged. And I know, for example, that the private hospital market in Australia could be dramatically impacted if these measures get up and it leads to... a turnover in the hospitals, a reduction in turnover in the hospitals by even something like 2 or 3%. So we could actually see quite a healthcare-shaped changing secondary impact.
These things are possible.
Yes.
Last question.
I think one of the greatest challenges facing private health insurance is how to retain the people who age off their parents' policies as dependents, depending on what age the insurer sets that at, 21, 25 or whatever. It's a real challenge to retain those people, and part of the reason you can't offer a particularly attractive policy is no matter how lean you make their hospital benefits, they've still got the same Medicare levies, they've still got the same risk equalisation charge to meet. And I think another thing that needs to change is the level at which you can set the excess has remained at $500 for many, many years. I think they need to allow a larger excess to attract the younger members and then possibly index it as well.
Thank you for that. Two items of housekeeping before we go. One, I'd like to get you to put your hands together for our speakers, including me.